Thanks everybody for coming. Can you hear me all right? I don't have any slides today. You can all read my paper online if you want the nitty-gritty details, but I thought I'd just talk in general about our monitoring system and how we went about sort of fixing a broken monitoring system. Everybody's sort of sitting in the back, so I'll move up a little bit, get the distance down. First off, I'll just say that the name of the paper is Fixing On-Call or How to Sleep Through the Night. One of the hardest parts of the paper was figuring out how to spell on-call. There seems to be three different ways of doing it, and nobody agrees. I went back and forth about five times, and in the end, decided on the hyphen. So I just want to make it clear that these are my opinions about this project and sort of how we fixed everything, but I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. So the goal here is to help other teams and other sysadmins kind of save some of that time that I've put into it. So just a quick question, how many of you are on call? No, ever, like in your job, yeah. It's a fair amount. And how many are running a team of sysadmins? Okay. Kind of, yeah. Ideally, those two sets of hands shouldn't overlap, but I know in the real world, sometimes they do. And how many people have sort of been burned out on call at some point in their careers? Is that what the little horns are for? Yeah. In my opinion, after working as a sysadmin for many years, on-call seems to be the number one cause of burnout. And kind of within on-call, it seems like the whole false alarm scenario seems to be within that the primary cause of sort of on-call burnout and people getting really, really sick of their jobs, basically, is what it comes down to. And false alarms are particularly dangerous because you get those alerts at 2 a.m. and you wake up and you go, oh, that thing's down. Well, it'll probably come back in 5 minutes. I'll just roll over and go to sleep, and hopefully it'll fix itself. They tend to stick around because nothing's actually broken. It's a false alarm, so you don't actually fix anything. So they just tend to last for ages, and after a year or so of that, you're like, I just keep getting woken up by the sort of same things, but there's nothing to fix. Really, the thing that you need to fix is Nagios or whatever monitoring system you're working with. And maybe beyond that, the bigger part of the project is fixing the way your team or yourself thinks about monitoring in general. What I decided in the end is that these false alarms or ignored alerts are essentially Nagios alerting you that it is the system that's down and broken and that needs fixing. And when I took a step back and looked at all our alerts and all these things, and I was doing some overall sort of metrics about like which systems cause us grief and everything, the most unreliable system we had was Nagios. I mean, sure, you end up with a disk array or something that periodically wakes you up, or there's different things, and we're trying to figure out which systems are the ones that are keeping us up at night, and it was mostly just Nagios telling us about things that didn't need to be fixed. So started a project to fix it, which turned out to be sort of harder than you think. The background was that we had a team that had been working together for about a decade, really. 6 to 8 guys working together for about a decade who had been using the same Nagios config for about 7 years. It goes all the way back to King Kong, if you can remember back that far. And so it had built up into this sort of monstrosity. There were hundreds and hundreds of hosts and thousands of checks. I think when I started this project, there were over 3,500 Nagios alerts that could go off. So if you look at your sort of typical week, what are the chances that some of those 3,500 alerts are going to go off? It's pretty high. We were sort of monitoring everything, and it had been built really from the bottom up, which is a tough way to do it, of wanting to know if the system is running by monitoring each and every component part of it that could possibly go wrong. And in a big complex system, there's really an infinite amount of parts that could go wrong. So over time, the number of alerts just kept going up and up and up as something would break, and you'd fix it and then add an Nagios alert and then go add that Nagios alert to any other system that resembled that one that broke. You know, so you could end up adding hundreds of alerts sort of in a single session if you encountered some sort of core problem. And it really reached this sort of breaking point where one of the admins started labeling some of the alerts with the suffix fix ASAP, which I like to call alert inflation. And you sort of had to, there was this sort of attempt to sort of start grading the alerts and saying, like, I know you normally ignore these kind of things, but you actually have to fix it. When in reality, any alert that you get should be actionable, right? Like, if you get woken up at 2 a.m., it should be for a real reason, and it should have a way for you to resolve that problem. But what was happening was, you know, some people on the team would wake up and go, well, that's not a critical problem. So I'll just wait to fix it until the morning. And the person that had set up that alert wasn't very happy with that sort of decision. And you know, this was coming into effect, especially with redundant systems. You know, so I guess different people have different ideas about when to leap into action on a redundant system. You know, if it disk fails in the middle of the night, but you have a bunch of spares, do you care or do you wait for the morning? You know, if a power supply fails on a system with redundant power supplies, do you leap out of bed at 2 in the morning and drive into the office and try to find a spare, or do you just wait until 8 a.m. and say, well, that's why I bought 2 power supplies, so I don't have to wake up? So, you know, NagiOS is a tricky thing because it's really a computer system programmed by humans to tell other humans what to do. And so it can be used as a means of control by people on the team of saying, my system is really important. When you're on call, you get up and look after it. And that's not really a decision that an individual should be making. It should be a team decision. And that's what we started working towards. So we set up a weekly retrospective meeting. So every Monday when somebody comes off call, we have a Monday morning meeting. It's run by the person that was on call the previous week, just coming off their shift. And they go open up their inbox and they go through every NagiOS alert that came out for the previous 7 days. And we go through it as a team and we say, okay, we got this alert. What was the story there? Who fixed it? You know, some of them everybody sort of knows about and we can kind of skip over pretty, like, yeah, that was the time that server went down or whatever. But what it really started showing was that there were tons and tons and tons of these false alarms, and you'd see these especially during the, you know, at night, but also during the day, where, you know, you'd get an alert and I'd say, okay, who did something about this? And nobody had done anything about it, and it's like, well, then why are we alerting if nobody's taking any action when the alert lands on your pager or in your inbox? And so we really started weeding these out, and that was a big part of it. Is even during the meeting, we would, you know, you bring a laptop and you have the NagiOS config open and you can change the config live right then and there and say, well, maybe we'll, you know, take this alert out or change it so it doesn't page you at night, something like that. And we came up with the idea of having a consensus-based NagiOS config. So we don't do it in a permissive basis. During the week, anybody can edit the config and add checks and everything else. But as part of that meeting, we go back through the config changes. You know, if you have your NagiOS configs in a version control system, it's really easy to do. You just rewind to the config 7 days ago and do a diff. And then we sort of go through that, and if somebody's snuck in an alert that they think, I think this system's really important and I think everybody should wake up to deal with it, you can have that debate. And it's consensus-based, not democratic. So it's not majority wins. It's essentially if one person in the room says, you know what, if I got that alert in the middle of the night, I would knock it out of bed and deal with it. The alert goes. That's it. You have to be able to sort of convince everyone in the team that this is a valuable thing, because otherwise it's you sort of imposing your priorities on the rest of the people. And my job as the manager of the team is to sort of be there and represent the business's priorities and sort of give that aspect to it. But really, it's mostly the team managing themselves. And you know, to do that, you have to create a safe environment for people to be able to object without thinking that they're sort of going to be bullied into, you know, saying yes to something that they're not comfortable with. So it does have to be this really collaborative sort of environment, which I think we've created. The other thing that we do is we prioritize fixing broken alerts, like alerts that are giving us false alarms or something, over most other work. Obviously, there's sort of day-to-day emergencies and stuff. But we recognize that these are broken systems and that it has to go to the top of our list. So we run a Kanban board for the team. I bring a stack of Post-it notes into this Nagios meeting, and somebody's like, oh, that alert's broken. Sometimes it gives a false alarm or something. Write it out straight up on the board. That's the next thing you're working on. Let's get this fixed before it bothers anyone else on the team. And even if you're not running your team in sort of a Kanban mode, which is something I would recommend, you can run a Kanban board just for this one meeting. And kind of as you go through, come up with action items, stick them up. Maybe the next week, the next Monday, go back and say, "Hey, did we fix this? Let's work on that." And it really helps us spot patterns, which is kind of one of the things I was doing early on. So, after a few weeks of doing this, you'll start to say, "Why does that server crash every week? You know, that same server crashes every week, and somebody goes in and restarts it. What's wrong with it?" And people will start to sort of raise this question themselves and say, "You know, I'm sick of seeing this. Is it the fourth week in a row we've had this thing go down? What's the underlying problem? Let's get to it." And in the past, when we didn't have this sort of overview, it was a different person every week, right? So somebody would be on call, the server would crash, they would fix it, done. It wouldn't bother them for another 6 or 7 weeks until they were on call again. So they wouldn't see the pattern that the next week it would crash again. And in fact, we started seeing time of day patterns where, you know, sometimes there was a particular server would crash every day at 12:15. And it had been doing that for months when we actually went back through our inboxes and looked at the timestamps on the Nagios alerts. It had been doing that for months, but nobody had seen the pattern because it would just crash one day at 12:15, they would fix it, and it wouldn't bother them again for a while. So having the whole team together looking at these was really valuable. And it also highlighted the percentage of alerts that are false. And I have to say it was really high in the beginning, and even after doing this for a year or so, it's still probably over half of the alerts are false. It's really tough getting to these, but we're getting through it slowly. And some of the cause for these false alarms is, you know, Nagios can be used as a sort of form of procrastination, where, you know, projects get about 90% done, you push them into production, they don't have all the sort of bells and whistles, so sometimes they still have a few problems, but now it's alerted, so now somebody will sort of take care of it. And I really think, you know, this is something that's missing when people sort of prioritize, is that time of day really has to be a factor in how you prioritize your work. You know, so you sort of look at something and say, well, that's only a 5-minute fix. It doesn't happen that often. Yeah, but it's 5 minutes on a Sunday morning, or it's 5 minutes, you know, at midnight. We have to, you know, in order to sort of keep our sanity as professionals, we have to sort of take that and say, well, but that's impacting on someone's personal life. So even though it's just a few minute fix, that has to be a priority to get resolved and potentially automated, which is usually the way out of this. And one of the things we did too is we started using PyNag, which is a Python module that can parse and mess with Nagios configs. Makes it really easy to do stuff, so you don't have to write a custom parser. So I started fighting fire with fire. So everybody really likes Nagios alerts. So now we have Nagios monitoring its own config. So for example, I set a policy that we don't alert on dev servers. So we tend to name our servers, you know, MySQL-dev or Postgres-dev or Apache-dev or something like that. So I wrote a PyNag check that opens up the Nagios config, looks at every host that's configured for monitoring, sees if any of them end in a -dev, and if it does, it sets off a Nagios alert until you fix it. So now if anybody goes in during the week and makes a configuration change that's against the sort of team's policy, it immediately sets off an Nagios alert, which probably isn't the best way of handling it, but is, again, the sort of fire with fire kind of thing. Like, if that's how we're going to keep things going, let's keep doing it. And it's led to some real changes in the way we run things. So now, daemon tools has kind of become a way of life. Before we started with this, basically there was no process control in the company anywhere, and stuff would happen rarely. You know, an Apache server would seg fault or something, and you'd get woken up, and you'd log in, and /etc/init.d, Apache start, back to sleep. But it's like, this is a solved problem, right? I prefer daemon tools. Other guys on the team use Monit or systemd, so we sort of have a whole grab bag of all these different systems. There's a new version of daemon tools called Runit, which is also really good. So, you know, that's what we do for everything now. And I made another rule for the Nagios config, which seems a little bit counterintuitive at first, which is that we don't monitor anything that isn't configured to fix itself. So if there's a way for a computer to fix it, we have to do that. We really only want to get woken up by exceptional circumstances. So something as simple as restarting a process, that just has to be done. If you have a daemon that's not set up that way, it doesn't go into Nagios until you do that. The eventual goal is to sort of build this into our Puppet configs as well. So when you Puppet a server, it automatically, you know, sets up the process control as well. And, you know, that's brought a lot of value to the organization as well as to people's time, because, you know, something like daemon tools noticing that Apache is seg faulted and restarting it takes seconds, which is always going to be faster than somebody getting woken up, finding their laptop, VPNing in, remembering which server it is, typing the command, whatever. So now a lot of these like little small problems that we'd have that would take 5 to 15 minutes to resolve are now resolving themselves. Another big one was log rotation. So we would get alerted about low disk space. I think that's a big problem for everyone. Disk space is always kind of one of those things. And it would turn out that some application was creating some log that hadn't been log rotated. Again, the rule is, you know, you have to configure the server to fix itself. So it has a finite amount of space. It has a bunch of logs. It should be configured to roll the logs up and deal with the amount of space. The other scenario that we cut into was we have been moving all our servers into VMware, and that creates this sort of artificial disk scarcity problem. So we were creating, I think our default VM image was like a 17-gigabyte drive, which is, you know, enough for a version of Linux and some stuff. But that's, you're in this weird world where you're creating machines with 17 gigs of disk space. I mean, if you go out and buy a new server, you can't buy them with like less than 300 or 600 gig drives. So in the sort of old physical server world, you would just never have this problem. But disk space in a shared environment is perceived as sort of more valuable. So, you know, the new rule that I have in these meetings is we don't monitor disk space on servers that have less storage than my phone. It's just ridiculous. Like, you're just spending this time chasing this goal of having it. And it was all to avoid thin provisioning, which we're now doing and which I highly recommend. And, you know, you can give every server a 300 gig root drive. Even if you don't have the backing storage for it, you're just counting on the fact that all of the servers don't use all of the space all at once. And you have to shift your monitoring up a level, right? And so now you're monitoring your disk arrays and saying, how much space did they have available for VMware? And I want to know at 80% and 90% so I can sort of step in and do something about it. But that's a little bit more strategic thinking, and that's more kind of capacity planning, hopefully, than it is alerting, where you get this alert that, like, wow, your disk array is almost full. You should have noticed that condition a little bit further along. And the other big change we put in was using Swatch, which is like an old Perl script that basically does a tailf on a log. You have a config file with a bunch of regexes. It looks for those regexes as the log stream is passed, and then it has actions that it can do, which is to, you know, exec something or mail, or basically the two things that you would want to do. So we had a phenomenon that I call Twiki script, because we use Twiki as our internal documentation wiki. And, you know, you'd wake up in the middle of the night with this alert. You hadn't seen it recently. You'd log in. There was a Twiki page that would have Nagios alerts and errors and what to do. So you'd say, I got this alert. And it would say, log into the server, look for this, you know, restart this, delete this, do this. I mean, it's basically human-readable computer code, right? You know, some of them even had sort of conditionals, you know, if this number is higher than this, do this. But yeah, I mean, computers can understand all this. If you're writing documentation for a sysadmin to be able to understand at 3 a.m. when they haven't, you know, had much sleep, it's got to be pretty simple. And if it's pretty simple, then a computer can do it. So now what we do is we took that step out and we look for these errors occurring in a log, and we just run a script. So you say, this error occurred in the log. Okay, what do I do to react to that error? If it's something that's known about, which it often is, right? So now the script can delete something and restart something and clean something up. And again, so we've sort of automated our way out of all these known ones. And you can use, there's other ones out there. Swatch is really simple and easy to use, but a little bit hard to manage if you have a lot of things. But now there's cool stuff like Logstash and Splunk can do kind of the same thing. You know, look for patterns in logs and send it off to run. We also started using it to replace, I'm not a big fan of thresholds. So, you know, the Nagios config used to have a lot of these threshold checks. Disk is one of them. It's not really that great. We're looking at replacing that with sort of predictive stuff, which takes into account not just how full the disk is, but how quickly it's filling. And it can tell you, you know, the disk will be full in 6 hours, that kind of thing. But we're using the swatch side of things to look for events, not thresholds. So, you know, we used to have alerts that would go off when the mail queue on the mail server got too big. But what's too big? You know, it's just some human-defined, you know, if it's more than 1,000, then alert me. But what does that mean? It could sit at 999 all night long and you wouldn't hear about it. But as soon as it ticks over to 1,000, like now it's an emergency. And it's a mail queue, right? It's queuing. It's doing what it was designed to do, which is to queue stuff. So now we have Swatch looking for actual, like, delivery errors in the mail log. Like, when the queue gets backed up so much that it's hitting whatever postfixes, you know, 10-minute retry is, and it says, I give up. We can watch for that specific condition and alert somebody, although typically not wake them up. So a couple weeks ago, I saw this really, really good quote on Twitter from Matt Groeninger. I probably slaughtered his last name. Sorry about that. I hope he's not here. But I thought it was about sysadmin and firefighting. So a lot of us describe our day-to-day jobs as firefighting, right? And he said, if you're constantly running from fire to fire, you probably aren't a firefighter. You're probably an arsonist. And I think, you know, some of this is like a natural reaction from people on the team. One of the things I cleaned up, there were a lot of personal alerts going out. So people would set up systems. You know, the storage guys would have the arrays emailing them directly, or even paging them directly, or the backup guy would have, you know, the backups paging him directly. And so there was kind of no incentive from these people to sort of 100% fix things, because they were sort of looking after them, and we've put a stop to that. So the rule now is, if you're on call, you get the alerts. If you're not on call, you're free, right? You can't, and it's tough because people, you know, their intentions are good. They're trying to sort of provide this level of service, but in the end, it just degrades their sort of quality of life until the point that they're burnt out, at which point they're kind of no good to anybody, right? Until you can kind of rehabilitate. So I really had to sort of step in and say, I know you're sort of doing this with good intentions, but you can't set up these systems to page you 24/7. You have to be able to take a break. You have to be able to go on vacation without, you know, things failing because you've just been keeping them running. The other thing I had to watch out for was kind of people's working hours. So usually people sort of work standard hours. I know sysadmins have a reputation for kind of being night owls, but we had a couple guys that were coming in really early in the morning. And they were using that time to sort of clean up all the systems that had sort of failed overnight before everyone else got in, which is, again, good. They're trying to sort of keep the place running, but the motivation really has to be to automate these problems and to make these systems run on their own and to set up systems that you can trust to run on their own and that don't need this sort of day-to-day supervision. But yeah, I mean, if you focus on making things better for the organization and for the staff, you can turn it around. But yeah, of the two, fixing computer systems and fixing human systems, is definitely the harder challenge, I would say. But in the end, you end up with much better results for the team and much better results for the company. So thanks for coming and listening.
Any questions?
Dude, we're going up to the mic when you're right there.
But yeah. Now I can back up.
Oh, yeah, well, that's good then. John Dedke from Groupon, and I wanted to ask a question about, you had mentioned really briefly, you're looking at, instead of thresholds, the disk is filling in 6 hours. What are you using for that, and how are you tackling that?
Yeah, we actually have a system like that for managing our sort of production render disk space, which is a kind of homegrown system, but there's plenty of documentation out there on how to sort of write these predictive things. There's a cool new one that uses Monte Carlo simulation to sort of predict when a disk is going to be full. But I think that's, it gets you away from that that just pure threshold number. You want to get a sense of how sharp the angle is. You know, if some disk has been slowly getting full for a year, and it trips over your 80% warning at 3 a.m. and you wake up and you're like, but it's not going to fill up for 6 months. You know, what was the point of that? You want to be able to catch it when it inflects up, and you know, maybe some system goes into an error mode and just starts spewing stuff into its error logs or something, and all of a sudden you say, well, this is going to be full in the next hour, and I need to do something about it. You know, and I guess that's if you haven't configured log rotate just to compress and ship the extra logs off somewhere. But I just, any place there's a threshold, it's a real warning sign in an Agios config, I think, that you've just sort of taken a punt and said, I don't really know when this is going to impact me, but I'm just going to put a sort of line in the sand and say, wake me up when this happens. And pretty often they're not accurate.
Did you have any challenges when you were first getting into this with your staff, where they just didn't want to do it this way, and how did you end up dealing with that?
Yeah, I mean, people were, it's tough, you know, because you think you're doing a good thing, and you think, like, I'm going to make your lives better, right? But people are used to sort of working the way they work. And there's also kind of an implication that what they're doing isn't that important, I guess. If, you know, everybody wants to think that the things that they're working on are sort of mission critical to the facility, but the harsh reality is that not everything is, right? And so when you sort of go through and say, well, actually, we're not going to wake people up for your system anymore, there can be a lot of resistance to that.
I've actually seen that where you write a recovery script where a condition happens, but you know it can be resolved by a script. A script can goes do it, but you might have accidentally stepped on someone's toes because they expected to be able to do it, and they're worried that, like, doing that in the middle of the night justifies their existence.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real worry.
Hi, Jake Davis from NASA. Do you have a side in some places? They have a religious war where this is a little Nagios technical bit where you can say, "Okay, alert me every 5 minutes until it's fixed," or alert me one time or however many set amount of times, and then don't alert me again until it's fixed. Do you come down on one side or the other?
Yeah, we have a setup with the tell me once and then tell me when it's fixed. I think, I wouldn't say I'm religious about it. I think that's the best of the two options. But I think it does allow you to sort of hide some of these things. We get into the situation, I think actually if you tell it to, in the second mode, I think it alerts you daily, or maybe that's just how we have it configured. So now it tells us, instead of every 5 minutes, it tells us every day, but we can still get stuck with alerts that go off daily for weeks, you know, every day, and somebody's like, oh yeah, like that thing's still, you know, missing its power supply, it's on back order, you know, it's just going to keep bugging me every day. But it's like, well, how valuable of an alert was that if it's going to be a multiple day long resolution time? And I think that's what you got to find too, is it depends on the sort of criticality of the system. You know, if your uptime needs to be sort of measured in minutes, then getting alerted every 5 minutes sort of gives you that, like, okay, it's still down, okay, it's still down, okay, it's still down. But we're not really in that position.
You might be able to tell I still harbor some bitterness towards an ex-manager of mine over that. One more little technical question. You mentioned PINAG, which sounds awesome. And the way you implemented it was that if the machine was configured to send alerts over the weekend, then you would send another alert. Could you just as easily said, turn off the alert automatically?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that was, I didn't want to be so brutal about it. I was trying to make a point, I guess is the thing. We put in another check too. We had this, we use a lot of CNAMEs. So typically, I know some places do this as well. You'll have the sort of physical name of the machine, which is what's on the front. But then because it changes roles over its sort of hardware lifespan, you always do like CNAMEs to it. But we had a whole bunch of CNAMEs pointing, you know, to the same machine. So you get this, you look in Nagios, especially after like a power outage or something, you'd be like, five servers are down. And then you go look and you'd be like, it's all just the same server. It just has five names. So I put in a PINAG check that resolves all the IPs for everything in Nagios. And if you put a server in twice, like with two different CNAMEs, it spits it, you know, it spits out an alert and says, don't do that.
Is that on GitHub? Because I could really use that.
No, but if you give me your details, I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
I certainly agree with the idea that tell us once if there's a problem, and then tell us later if it's fixed is good. I mean, it got to the point where people in our group were referring to this particular tool as nagging us.
Right.
Because, you know, you told me, you've already told me, even though it told us once an hour, you know, that was too much. But even telling us when it's fixed isn't necessarily adequate because, for example, one of the things we do is monitor whether a particular file system is getting full, say 90%, or whether the load average on, you know, any of our several hundred compute nodes is over some threshold. But the problem is that if something oscillates right around the threshold, you get told there's a problem. Oh, it's been fixed. There's a problem. It's been fixed.
Yeah. And what I'm hoping... And that's the problem with threshold alerts in general, right?
Well, what I'm hoping is that there's some... In fact, I'll use this opportunity. I put something up on the BOF board for this evening to talk about monitoring systems because I would desperately love to find something other than what we're using, but I'm not convinced yet that any of the others aren't just as bad. But I'd like to find out what people like and dislike about everything that's out there. But what I was hoping to find was some tool which has two thresholds, and it would alert us when something went over the top threshold, and then would give us an okay only when it passed below the lower threshold, and that would eliminate a lot of the oscillation issues. And are there any nagging us tools that and any monitoring tools out there that do that sort of thing?
I don't know if there are any built into any of the sort of mainstream ones. I mean, I have seen, you know, there's papers and stuff about how to do this kind of thing. But I think really it's still kind of the wrong approach. I mean, you're still saying, like, we'll do thresholds, but we'll just do smarter thresholds. And, you know, if you take another step back and just say, I want to know when the server is behaving badly. Like, I want to know, you know, and then you get into all this cool stuff like baselining and everything where you say don't, you know, yeah, heuristics and baselining where you say don't set a hard number, just say the server's usually here and today it went up to here. And that's what I want to know about, and let me know when it sort of gets back to where it should be.
In our environment, that would cause a huge number of alerts that, you know, that's our typical mode of operation. Something is idle for a few days and then it gets used heavily for a few hours. So that wouldn't apply to
us. Yeah,
if
a system's smart enough, though, it can figure that out. That's the, you know, that's the goal of these things. Computers can be pretty smart if you let them.
I can just talk loud. This is kind of more of a humorous observation than a question, though. One time we had an application administrator who said, well, I want to have Nagios monitoring for this complicated web application I have. And it was something where it wasn't really suitable to do an active check, where the Nagio server would just, like, you know, check whether HTTP was running. So he said, well, okay, here's how you can write a Nagio's passive check script, and we'll set up the corresponding stuff in Nagio's. And so he wrote the passive check script, and I think somehow we noticed that, like, it would only ever alert once about any problem he had. And it somehow prompted us to go look at the script, and we discovered that when he coded the passive check script, if it detected the service was down, it would return that status to Nagios, but it would also immediately try to restart his application.
Right.
Which we kind of said, well...
Which is the right idea.
That's kind of an interesting approach, but that's maybe not the best way to do that.
I mean, that's exactly what you should be doing, but you shouldn't be setting off the alert if you can fix it, right? But that's the idea, is that if the computer can just fix it, then just fix it, and don't tell me about it.
Well, we use puppets. We suggest maybe we should, like, set up the puppet code to do the application restart, check and restart, rather than doing it in the Nagios check, which is...
Yeah, now, that's a good example of being a little bit too clever, yeah. Thanks for that. Okay. Okay, that's interesting. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Matt.
Yeah.
So, thanks everybody for coming. I'll just note that since we do have a little extra time at the end of this session, if you're interested, we have OpenStack is over in the Lisa Lab. So, if you have ever interested in, like, hey, what is this whole VM thing on OpenStack look like? I've got a bunch of folks over there set up with VMs you can try out and technical folks you can sit down with. So this would be a good time with some extra time at the end of the session to go check that out if you're interested. So thanks everyone for coming. Thanks for our presenters.